don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
If you've ever listened to this show, you'll know that we like to chat to people who have achieved big things in their own careers and who also have a great sporting story to tell. And I feel like we've got the perfect balance on today's Second Captain Saturday. Oh, my David here with Kieran Murphy. Hey, Murph.
Hey, Owen. How's it going?
Colm McCann has twice been nominated for a Booker Prize and was recently described as one of the finest writers of his generation, Irish or otherwise. And if you think that sounds like high praise, when we heard Colm was going to be on the show today, I asked you, Murph, if you're a fan of his work. And you replied, I've probably read every word he's ever written.
Well, I'm sure there's some words that he's written that were unpublished. But most of the published words, you're often asked what your favourite book is, right on? And at 18, I might have told you one thing. At 30, I might have told you something else. But if you're asking me right now, Transatlantic by Colm McCann is my answer. So here's one metric on. I don't think I've bought more copies of a book for other people than I've bought Transatlantic. That's got to be a pretty good sign, right? A Pyragon is the book I recommend to people who want to try and get to the heart of Israel and Palestine. Dancer is like just a triumph of biographical fiction, which is a thing I don't even know how you do. Ah, bloody hell, Owen, I'm fanboying to an embarrassing degree here. Put a stop to me, please. But let's just say I'm a big, big fan of Colm McCann.
That's all right, Murph. You're not embarrassing yourself in front of our guest, which is the main thing. You're just talking to me. We're talking to Colm at a great time as well, around the 50th anniversary of a man named Philippe Petit walking on a tightrope between the two towers of the World Trade Center, an act I saw hailed this week as the greatest athletic feat of all time. Certainly one of the craziest athletic feats of all time. It was this moment that Colm used as a thread that pulls together all the different stories in another one of his great books, Let the Great World Spin, which has gone down as one of the best books ever written about New York, Colm's adopted home city of 30 years. That's the Colm McCann you know, but did you know that his father, as well as being an author and features and literary editor at the Evening Press, was also a professional goalkeeper who wrote kids' football books, and Colm himself cut his teeth as a young sports reporter. There you go. That's the side of Colm McCann that will be revealed to you over the next hour. Murph, your scoring system has looked vulnerable this season.
Wow.
Gotta be honest, you caved to the pressure of your colleagues, mostly me last week, to upgrade Mowgli Bapp's score. Everyone is listening intently to see how you rank Colm's sporting achievements today. So how are things looking in the second captain's greatest non-sportsperson race?
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Owen, can I just say what a classless introduction that was? You've really shown yourself up there. Nevertheless, unbeaten and unbowed, I rise above your petty insults. Our current leader is Brendan Gleeson on 83 points, and he has successfully held off the challenge of first Mowgli Bapp and then Kirsty Wark thus far this season. Has Colm McCann got what it takes in the key categories to knock him off top spot? Remember, I must assess Colm's all-time sporting highlight, choose the sports person that I feel most closely resembles him, and then, having weighed up his sporting achievements, give him a point score out of 100. That's the job at hand, and I will not be distracted by the hurlers on the ditch telling me how to go about my business. 83 is the score to beat to take top spot at the halfway stage in the race to become Ireland's greatest non-sports person for 2024, Owen.
Forget about top spot for a second. Can Colm go one better than Rashida Adeleke last night and claim a place on the podium at least? Ugh, I'm still in shock at that 400 metres. I feel a bit like Rashida did at the start of her post-race interview when she was barely able to speak for a while. Fourth in an Olympic final. It's both an unbelievably gut-wrenching moment and an incredible achievement all at the same time. An especially incredible achievement for a 21-year-old Irish athlete in a sprint event. I can't get over it, Murph.
Yeah, it is. The cognitive dissonance would be enough to, you know, knock a rhino from 100 yards away. Because you can be both disappointed and also in awe, you know. Like, these are two things that you can actually hold side by side. And they're not even that contradictory, you know. We only expect amazing things because she has done amazing things and already. She will do amazing things. So, that's kind of it, isn't it? You know, you just get greedy. She's 21 on. Oh, man. She's 21 years old. Like, all of the medalists are 27, 28. They're, you know, championship veterans. And that's what we need to remember while we're half feeling the disappointment and then also just feeling the pride and the kind of amazement that you must feel to have an Irish athlete, as you say, in a sprint event finishing fourth in the Olympic Games.
We might not have to wait too long to see her do something amazing again, Murph. She's going tonight in the final track race of the entire Olympics, the women's 4x400 relay. It's usually one of those big time events that we watch from afar, but tonight we're in there with the heavy hitters of world sprinting. And what I would say to your Jamaicas, your USAs of this world, just watch out if Charlene Maudsley is chasing it down on that final leg. She is the master of the relay. Finished like a train in the semi-final. And hopefully we'll do it again this evening. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at Second Captains. Email editor at secondcaptains.com. Colin McCann coming right up. That's Strange Currencies by REM on Second Captain Saturday. Our guest today is an international best-selling author who's won the National Book Award in the US and written an Oscar-nominated movie. But cycling around Dunleary as a young lad, writing match reports for the Irish press, that's the kind of thing that counts as hard currency around these parts. Colin McCann, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on.
What age were you when you were writing these match reports around Dunleary?
Believe it or not, I started writing for the newspapers at the age of 11, 12 and continued it right through to 16. So I go around, Tech Workman's Club, out to Bray Wanderers on my bicycle. And I'd pick up whoever scored the goals and write a little match report. People would look at me and say, who's this little snot on his bicycle coming along and asking us how the game went? And then the report would appear. I don't know if you remember all those years ago, every match would be highlighted, a paragraph each. And believe it or not, so I got paid a lot of money. So at the beginning, it was £5 per match. And then it was £10 per match. So I would go to three matches per Sunday or Saturday and give in a little report. That was the beginning of my journalism career.
It sounds more lucrative than novel writing at this stage. I mean, do you often think maybe I should have just stuck at it?
I think so. I probably should have. It's definitely more lucrative than novel writing at the moment. But you know what it was a grounding in getting to know people. Because I was quite young and I was talking with people like Pat Devlin, who was there. He was at Workman's Club for a while. I was playing myself. I used to play for Pearce Rovers. I played for St. Joe's. Played for a number of other teams. But I came from a football family. And my father was also a journalist. So all of these things were tying in together. I didn't think it was unusual at the time. But now, when I think back on it, it's quite amazing. Mm. I mean, I remember lashing along out to Bray in the rain, in my anorak, coming back with my notebook soaked. And then you'd have to call it in to the copy people in the Irish press. And it was actually a wonderful grounding in dealing with people.
You say you came from a football family. Your dad sounded like he was a pretty decent goalkeeper.
My dad was a great goalkeeper. My dad went to England in the late 1940s and started playing for Charlton Athletic. He was second string goalkeeper for Charlton Athletic. A great goalkeeper there by the name of Sam Bartram was always going to be the first string keeper. But my dad got paid 2 and 6 a week, which is really now the equivalent of about at most 50 quid a week. And he used to have to clean the boots, and he remembers vividly being at the Valley and shooing the rats out from the dressing room, which surely is a metaphor for something or other. But he was a good goalkeeper, and he played once for an Irish amateur 11. They played against England, and the headline was McCann saves Ireland, and he lost that particular thing along with a league medal when his overcoat got stolen a few years later. But it was a proud moment for him, and he was a good keeper.
Wow. Did he talk much about those days? I mean, if he was keeping the clipping in his overcoat, then it suggests that it meant a lot to him. What sort of memories did he have of that time?
It meant a lot to him. And here's the deal. So when I was growing up, my dad would bring us across to England to watch the world's greatest goalkeepers at the time, Peter Shilton and Gordon Banks. By default, and for my sins, I became a Stoke City fan, and I'm still a Stoke fan to this day. But I'd be there with my dad, and he'd be saying, "Watch Banksy now." And I was more interested in watching Terry Conroy, who was the Irish player out on the left wing with that, you know, shock of red hair on him, and because I was a midfielder. And Dad would say, no, but look at where Banksy is. He's outside the box there and everything. I said, Dad, come on, let me watch the match. But we'd go to Stoke, and it was the early 1970s. And those trips, they weren't many, but they were extraordinarily meaningful for me. And I also went at that time down to London to watch Stoke against Arsenal. And that was the first time that I ever met my grandfather, because my grandfather at that stage lived in London too. And that was one of those moments where, you know, the world gets defined for you.
Oh, well, can you tell us a bit more about that then? What happened that day?
Well, that day we drew 1-1 against Arsenal, and my dad took me by the hand, and you know, he was a wonderful father, but not necessarily always demonstrative. And we had bought on the ferry over, we had bought a bottle of whiskey and 200 cigarettes. And now my father didn't smoke, and he didn't really drink. He drank wine, but he didn't really drink heavily. And I had wondered why we were carrying these around with us. And as we came out of the stadium, he said, "You're on your way to see your grandfather." And he was in a nursing home in Pimlico. He was quite a character in his years. We came in the door. I remember standing framed in the door, my dad looking up, and my grandfather saying, "Who's that?" And he said, "It's Sean, your son Sean." And I remember thinking, "Oh, that's odd. He's dad, he's not Sean." And he said, "Who's that with you?" And he said, "It's your grandson, Colm." And my grandfather goes, "Another effing McCann." But my father gave me the whiskey, because he wouldn't want to give him the cigarettes. I sat up on the bed, gave him the whiskey, and my father gave him the cigarettes in that curious Irish ritual of things. And we sat with him, and he told us stories about growing up and being involved, you know, with the IRA back in the day, and you know, all sorts of incredible stories, going to Spain and fighting in Spain. I remember coming out of that nursing home on that day thinking, wow, this is an extraordinary world that we live in. And my father thinking that, you know, I might, you know, I wanted access to something, you know, as a young person, brought me to the Hard Rock Cafe. Now, this is 1974, 1975. And there was an Irish waitress in the Hard Rock Cafe. And she touched my face just very lightly touched my face. And then she brought me an ice cream sundae. I'm sure she was very young, but to me at that stage, she seemed like an elderly lady. And I will never, every time I touch down in London or walk around London, I remember that Irish waitress and the texture of that particular day. It was one of the great days.
It's such an extraordinary memory. It's so poignant as well that your grandfather was one of these Irish people who obviously emigrated to London. And I don't know, did he lose contact with home, or why it was that you were only meeting him for the first time in a trip that was sort of tagged on to this football match that he'd attended?
Yeah, well, they largely lost contact. But, you know, at that stage, even going to Mayo was a big trip. Going over to England was a huge sort of deal. And my grandfather, if I put it delicately, had an interesting relationship with the bottle. Mm-hmm. And that was all part of it. But my father sort of still worshipped him in many ways, and was able to fill in all the background to the story. My grandfather had become a security guard on a building site in London. But earlier on, he had been he'd looked after the Aga Khan's horses up in Leopardstown.
Right.
And so he had wanted to be a jockey. He was too big to be a jockey. This is my grandfather. And he ended up looking after the horses. And so that was another thing in the whole mythology of the father, grandfather, and the depth of the sporting engagement that came in the family.
Is it true that he also, your father, this is, he also wrote a fictional book based on football called, I love this title, Goals for Glory?
He certainly did. Yeah. He actually wrote 7 kids' soccer books. And so he was a journalist and he was the features editor in the Evening Press. And he wrote books, you know, he wrote about the world of Brendan Behan, the world of Sean O'Casey. But the books that I loved the most, the Georgie Good series. Now, guess where Georgie Good came from? And he was from an itinerant family. That's what the word that was used at the time, an Irish itinerant family living in England. And Georgie Good's thing was that he never had any boots. He only had the plimsolls, the sneakers. And then Georgie would get in all these adventures because his father's caravan would be burnt out or they had to move around and things like that. And so Dad would write these books. And so the music of my childhood was him sitting out in the shed at the side of Clonkeen Road in Dean's Grange, tapping away in the typewriter. And he worked on these big, long rolls of newspaper paper. And he would bring the rolls into me, like through 2 foot long, 3 foot long, and asked me to read them in a sort of serial manner as the books emerged. So at a fairly young age, I suppose in a weird way, I was also becoming an editor. I would just tell him if I liked them or if I didn't like them, or if I liked what happened to Georgie or if I didn't like him. But when the books actually came out, that this is an extraordinary thing. When the books came out, I went to St. Bridget's School in Fox Rock. And my teacher at the time, Mr. Kells, God bless him, it was an amazing teacher, third class. He said to all the class that he would read the Georgie Good books over the course of a month or 2 months. If we behaved ourselves on a Friday afternoon, he'd read a different chapter. And I will never forget when he read the last chapter of Goals for Glory, and right in front of me, in the seat in front of me, Christopher Howlett like jumped up out of the seat because Georgie scored a goal. He punched the air. And I was thinking, wow, that's amazing, because that moment came out of my father's head, which came out of my father's shed, which came in a weird way out of my life. And I think to me, that was one of the first times that I truly understood the power of writing. And, you know, for me, it was ordinary. But look back on it now, it was truly extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't think many young writers or writers looking back at their youth get such a visceral example so early in their life of the punch that a book can carry. You know, this, for yeah. So many people, reading a book is a delightfully solitary thing to do. But in this particular occasion, you actually get a chance to see that, okay, it can be a different thing. It can actually bring like a huge kind of a emotional reaction out of a reader as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there were, my father being a journalist, I sometimes got to go in and go into the Irish Press. And one of my great heroes from an early age was Con Hoolan. He was the greatest sports writer that Ireland has ever seen. I would venture to say he was probably one of the world's greatest sports writers. And he sort of took me under his wing in a little way. And later on in life, I got to interview him and went out to his little house in Portobello and talked to him about his relationship to football, to horse racing, to betting, to all of these things. You know, in my life, that was, you know, my father introducing me to all these different people and all these different things, and the world getting bigger and bigger and bigger as we went along.
When you say Con Hoolan took you under his wing, in what way?
Well, he would read my copy, believe it or not.
Wow.
And he would comment on some of the things that I was writing. So at the age of 16 and 17, I was doing some feature stories. Then I went to the College of Commerce, Rathmines, the journalism course. There were times I would go into the press, go back into Mulligan's, and there would be that crew of guys, printers and journalists and stuff, and they would allow me to sit in and sort of observe some of that stuff that was going on. It was the heyday of Irish journalism, but it was also a time when things were still pretty rough around the edges. But watching someone like Con Hoolahan was, I'll tell you one funny story about Con, because you probably know that he was from Kerry, had a deep Kerry accent. He was kind of difficult to understand. He often would obscure his face with his hand, and it was hard to understand what he was saying. You know, he'd been talking like this now. It wasn't always possible for him to be understood. I was with him in his house one day, coming up to 3 o'clock. Con picks up the phone And in the clearest voice, he says, I will have £10 on such and such a horse in Cheltenham, you know, at 3 o'clock, in the clear as a bell, because he knew he didn't want to be misinterpreted. The rest of the time, you know, he was tough to understand. There was only one copy taker in the Irish press who knew exactly what Conn was saying all the time. And when he was calling in from Stuttgart and places like that, she was always had to be on duty because he would call in his copy over the phone.
What did that newsroom look and feel like to you as a teenager and even as a younger kid when your dad would bring you there?
Amazing. That hive of activity, the things that were going on, you know, the copy desk talking to the news desk and the sports desk over here, and just the hive of activity, the copy boys going back. And then you go back from the newsroom into the printing presses, and the smell of the printing presses and the oil and the taste in the air. And my father standing over the printing presses, being able to read the stuff backwards because it was coming up backwards off the rollers. And he was as fluent backwards as he was forwards.
It's a superpower.
And just watching the way all the journalists interacted. And I even got to meet people like, you know, Ben Kiley. And of course, Jan Banville was there at the copy desk at that time. I didn't know John very well, but he was there. And a lot of good people came out of the that era of journalism.
Here's something, Colm, that I can't quite wrap my head around. You've described so evocatively and so brilliantly the romance of the idea of being a journalist at that time. Your father brought you into that world, and yet he told you, or he advised you gently, not to become a journalist yourself. Why was that?
Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, I told him I wanted to be a journalist and wanted to be a writer. But I think he saw that world and he saw it in all its clarity. It wasn't easy. I kind of, you know, we can romanticize it a little bit and I can talk about mulligans and all of that sort of stuff. But those were tough years. They were hard years. There were people, you know, making ends meet. There was a lot of drinking going on, a lot of broken families, a lot of things that my father sort of recognized that might not be necessarily good for me. But in a curious way, I think he said it to me because he really wanted me to actually do it, if you know what I mean.
Reverse psychology.
Reverse psychology, and I did. I got into it, fairly young. I left. I worked in the press. I worked in the Herald first because I didn't want people to say it was nepotism, and then they got mad at me because I was working for the Herald. so I came back over the river, but. I left at the age of 21 and went away to try to write a novel and failed miserably and ended up taking a bicycle across the United States from the age of 21 to 23. Gave up, supposedly, on the journalism, but not really, because I was writing a column back every week about my cycling adventures.
Well, what was that? What was the novel you were trying to write at that age?
Oh, my God. It was called Uncle Saccharin, and it's so bad that
do you still have it?
I still have it. Even if my family tried to publish it on me, they wouldn't be able to publish it. It was woeful, absolutely woeful. But you know, I started writing writing my own life out of myself, and being more interested in other people. In fact, I have two books like that will stay in the drawer forever.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of learning you have to do as a 21-year-old, but there's probably a lot of living you have to do as well. And was that kind of the original idea of the cycle, that you take yourself out of Dublin, you take yourself out of your upbringing, and you kind of try and meet the world where it is?
That's exactly it. I mean, I'm conscious of it now, but at the time it was more like, Jesus, what am I going to do? There was a group of us Irish people living in a house in Hyannis in Cape Cod. I think there's about 20 of us. And one night when we were all a little bit overserved, I said, come on, let's do this mad journey. We're going to go. We'll buy a bus and we'll all go together. We'll go to the West Coast. We'll be like Ken Kesey and the rest of them. And everyone said yes. And then a couple of days later, when I checked out the price of a bus and the price of insurance and et cetera, they're like, well, I've got to go home to college. Yeah, well, I've got to do this. And eventually it came down to the fact that nobody really wanted to go. So I went with a friend of mine and we went on bicycles. And then she stopped. We went from all the way from the East Coast down to New Orleans. She stopped in New Orleans. I went on my own and spent the next year and a half down around Texas, Mexico, New Mexico, all the way up to Canada and down to California, and emerged out of it a different person.
Wow. So you were working on the road as well, were you? Like, what sort of people did you meet on this trip?
Oh, it was amazing. And now when I think about America and how it's changed, it's really fascinating for me. But, you know, I was down south and I was, I would meet people, poor people in Mississippi, wealthy people. People wanted to come tell me their stories. I worked, painting houses. I did some bartending in New Orleans. I did some ditch digging, of all things, in Idaho for forest fires, made enough money to keep going. But it was the most incredible journey. And I do recommend it to young people and to any parents who are there, think who are a bit scared of their youngsters doing something that doesn't seem to compute at first. Because a lot of people looked at me and my friends and said, you used to be a journalist with the, you know, you were 21, you were right on the ladder. You could have gone anywhere. And there you are. You're on your arse, cycling around.
Digging ditches in Idaho.
Exactly. And it was the best experience for me because when you're young, you can do that sort of stuff.
When you say you came out of it a different person, what do you mean by that?
I learned how to listen. I learned the real value of storytelling was not in me telling my story, but in the way others wanted me to take their story and almost vicariously become a novelist by taking it down into my belly and moving down the road with it. The thing is that we look at people and we have to listen to them. And the real value for me in the world is other people. And I've been in places where I don't have the language, but you can still talk to people. And in fact, often you talk to people. I'm not just saying this because we're on the show. Often you can talk to people through the language of football. You can mention a goalkeeper's name. You can mention a striker's name. And people understand where you're coming from. And these connections get made. And you look at each other differently. All we need is one little spark for all the connections to come together.
A coast-to-coast cycle across the US, I have to say, is an impressive athletic feat as well. You are listening to Colin McCann, who's building a strong case for himself in our greatest non-sportsperson competition. We're back after these.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
50 years ago this week, a young Frenchman named Philippe Petit walked on a wire between the two towers of the World Trade Center, an act of subterfuge that today's guest on Second Captain Saturday, Colin McCann, used as the focal point of his best-selling novel about New York, Let the Great World Spin. Colin, what was it about that act that inspired you to base an entire book around it?
Well, I was here in 9/11 when the towers came down, and I was here with my family. My wife and at that stage, two kids. And we sat and we watched the towers come down on television. My father-in-law, her father, was in the first building to be hit, the second building to come down. He got out, but we didn't know that for many, many, many hours. And during those hours when I walked around and I went to the blood bank, but they weren't taking blood because there wasn't going to be any survivors. I walked and walked and walked. And as I walked through Manhattan that day with that haze of ash in the air and people stunned, but people very resilient as well, I remembered an essay that Paul Auster had written about a man who had walked a tightrope in 1974 between the World Trade Center towers. And it struck me that man would never be able to happen again. And I put it back in the back of my brain thinking, you know, all the things that I was thinking the day of 9/11. And about 3, 4, 5 years later, I thought, well, I've got to pull that out and see if it's something that I wanted to talk about. Because I did want to talk about 9/11, but I didn't want to talk about the grief machine that it had become at the time. And I wanted to find something celebratory. So his act of creation, putting a tightrope between the towers and walking across it 6 times in the early morning in August 74, was in exact opposition to the act of destruction that happened 27 years later. And I thought, well, there's a good metaphor, and let's see what I can get out of that.
Why did you decide to do it that way, rather than confront 9/11 head on, to write about it in the way that you've described there?
I thought that most people would write about 9/11 head on, and I think that it was so affecting and so awful and so traumatic that if you come at it, as Emily Dickinson would say, if you come at it slant, you might be able to tell a deeper truth about it. Because sometimes hitting things on the nose doesn't actually work. But if you come at it a little bit sideways, and it allows people to think, look, I think the great lie about writers is that they're smart. You know, and that they know all sorts of things. None of us are smart, but the intelligence comes in allowing readers to unleash their own intelligence. So it's not for me to say how the world is, but it is for me to try to make people feel certain things, because I can do certain things with language that allows people to walk into a place. It's almost like being a language camera. And they can live in that particular reality. So I wanted people to try to understand, and of course myself, because when I was in 1974, I was 9 years old. I was in August 74, I was probably on holidays in Ballybunion.
Yeah,
you know, fishing off the side of the pier. So I had to go back in and recreate what New York in 1974 was by research and hanging out with cops and talking with all sorts of people in the South Bronx and places like that. Also, I wanted to write a New York novel, because New York is my sort of adopted city. Dublin is my city, but New York is my adopted city.
You mentioned your father-in-law and the kind of the absence of information that you guys had to live through for those terrible hours after the two planes hit. How did you find out that your father-in-law was actually safe and sound?
He came to our apartment, and he had gotten out and just before the towers fell. So the first tower had fallen. So he walked into that glaucoma storm of debris. And so he had like dust on his suit jacket, dust on his shoes, dust in his hair. And so when he finally got to, he walked the 5 miles to our apartment. When he finally came up, my daughter ran down the corridor, jumped into his arms. And then she recoiled from him, and found her in the cupboard, and she was hiding. I said, "What's wrong, love?" And she was 3 years old, and she says, "Poppy's burning, Poppy's burning." I said, "No, love, there was a fire downtown, and Poppy's going to be okay." She said, "But no, you don't understand, Dad." And this is from the mouth of babes. She said, "He's burning from the inside out." And that was another one of those things where I thought, oh, wow, I'm going to remember this for a long, long time. Now, he took off his clothes and changed them, and he threw them all away, except for his shoes, which are now in the museum, the 9/11 Memorial Museum in downtown Manhattan, with all the dust still on them.
Wow. Why do you think Philippe Petit did what he did? Why did he decide to, and how did he execute the feat of walking on a tightrope between the towers?
So just the middle of this week, I got to see Philippe.
He
did a 50th anniversary walk in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine just a couple of days ago.
Wow.
And, you know, and I talked to him again about why he did what he did. And he said, well, because they were there. The towers, I walked the towers because they were there. But then I fundamentally started like drilling him. Yeah. And it was an act of beauty. For him, it was an audacious act of beauty. And he knew that not many people, if any other people in the world, could do this thing. And he wanted to create something that became, and it did actually become the art crime of the 20th century. He sees himself as an artist. He never once thought of falling. Now, he was a quarter of a mile in the sky. He walked, as I said, back and forth six times, carrying a 42-pound balancing pole. He even lay down on the wire. And he danced his way in. And so this celebration that took place this week was really gorgeous, because Sting, the singer, was there, and he sang as Philippe was walking on a tightrope inside the cathedral. In front of 1,000 people, and Sting sang a brand new song. Believe it or not, this is crazy to me. It was absolutely crazy moment. But he sang a brand new song called "Let the Great World Spin."
Ah, oh, come on, that's amazing.
I know.
What amazing. A night that must really, have been. Really, really amazing.
It was fantastic. I'm still recovering from it.
You wrote an op-ed about Petit in the New York Times this week, and I'm curious to hear what a thrill it must have been for you, as an Irishman who's lived in New York for so long, that when the Times decides they want to write about this incredibly indelible image of the city in the 1970s, you're the person who gets to tell that story.
It's humbling, and it's constantly surprising, and you never think that you never take any of this stuff for granted. I mean, it does amaze me to wake up and to think, wow, I had I got a chance to write a story in the New York Times. But I also remember back in the days, in the early days, the apprenticeship, being down in Castlebar working for the Connacht Telegraph and having the same sort of feeling. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. When I was down in the Connacht Telegraph for a summer, I played a couple of games with the Castlebar Mitchells, and I had to report on one of the games that I was playing in. You know?
How generous were you in your own performance there?
Best for Castlebar Mitchells were.
I wasn't very good. I wasn't all that good a player. You know, even when I went in my football days, I told you I played for Joes and stuff. I mean, I was good. I ended up stopping playing the football, in fact, as a teenager, because I think I was chickening out of the tackles a little bit, and I also, you know, had some stuff. I was playing, as I said, I was playing with Joes. I used to go up to Sally Noggin. My mum, who's probably listening to this right this very minute, she'll remember my father was the only person on from my whole team who owned a car. And I used to get a bit of slagging about that. And, you know, you get roughed around. So at around the age of 15, 16, I stopped playing football. I still played for my school, which was Clonkeen College. But I started playing. And this is not embarrassing to Irish people, but it's embarrassing when you tell it to Americans. I started playing badminton.
No, nothing embarrassing about that. We had Nat Nguyen, the Irish badminton player there, doing very well at the
Badminton's
Olympics.
Having a moment over here.
Can I tell you, just watching the Olympics and how proud I am. I was walking down Lexington Avenue just the other day, past the bar, which is on 84th Street, and people spilling out of the bar, shouting about Kelly Harrington, and you think that act only took place in Paris and Ireland and Ireland itself? No, it took place everywhere. You know, people crying for the fact that she'd won the gold medal, and it's pretty incredible how we have done. It's nice to watch it actually from afar. And to see, you know, all the great stuff that is happening, and yes, the badminton. But people over here don't understand badminton in quite the same way that we do.
You have been living in the US for a long time now, Colm. You wrote once that you slipped into America via baseball.
I did. My son, look, I knew nothing about baseball, but my son John Michael became a baseball player, and. And so I would have to go to his matches, you know, and he was going along. Then he became a fan of the New York Yankees. And so we would be going out to Yankee Stadium. And then he'd be saying, okay, Dad, this is what's happening here. And this is what's happening here. And this is a bunt. And this is such and such a thing. And a fly catch and three strikes and all these things. So I was learning baseball. And in a curious way, I was becoming the son of my son.
Yeah, what a lovely inversion. The usual.
Yeah, so baseball sort of taught me America, and but we also have a solid relationship, with Ireland. I go back, you know, 4 or 5 times a year. My daughter has a stronger Irish accent than I have at this stage. She wears the Irish shirts down. She works down in Washington, D.C. She wears the Irish shirts whenever there's a match going on. And for her sins, I have to tell you that she is... I cursed her because she is a Stoke City fan.
Oh my God.
As well.
I think they call this intergenerational trauma.
That's exactly it. Yes. But we sit together, and part of the beauty of our relationship, she's 27 now, is that we watch the matches together. And I'll be watching on my screen, she'll be watching on her screen, and you know, suddenly a text will come through, and yes, you know, with the exclamation mark. And we know all about the players, the ins and outs, and so we're hopeful for this season, but we're also realists. And we're Stoke City fans, so we know the world will not necessarily treat us well.
The big question before we rank your sporting life here, Colm, is what is the all-time sporting highlight? We're not talking about anything that you've watched or anything that you've experienced or some big day at Yankee Stadium. I'm talking about your own illustrious-sounding sporting career. What's your own highlight?
I have so many failures. It's kind of funny, but I will say that when I was 11 years old, I had been playing for Pierce Rovers, and then I went to another team called Patrician Villas in Stillorgan. And it was a tough team. And we had a guy on the team, we called him Kojak. And the reason he was called Kojak was he'd been caught nicking stuff in Stillorgan shopping centre, right? And his dad had punished him by shaving all his hair off. Right. And so at that stage when you're a kid, you know, you do not want to have a bald head. But Kojak went into the shopping center and nicked himself a wig. And and he was a character. But I remember we weren't very good. But we were playing against a team, and I can't even remember the team. I think it was some sort of Kilmacud team, local team, that was quite strong. And they were going to win the league, but there was a bit of niggle between us, and we're 3-0 down at halftime. And this is like out of Georgie Good, you know, the goals for glory sort of thing. But I remember scoring the fourth goal from way out, and my father being on the sideline cheering and thinking, and he actually told us that if we were good, we were going to get ice cream and lemonade after the match, if we won the match. And we won the match 4-3, and I remember Kojak like jumping around on the side, and that was one of my favorite sporting memories, winning that one particular game and scoring the winning goal as well.
That's a highlight. That's a heck of a highlight. Listen, you've done all you can, Colm, but your fate is now out of your hands. It's out of my hands as well. Murph, could you please rank this sporting life of Colm McCann?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Colm, it's been a delight. You're a great man for the writing, of that there is absolutely no doubt. But I can't even begin to tell you how little that counts as I analyse your all-time sporting highlight. Pick an athlete that I feel most closely resembles you and your sporting achievements, your many sporting achievements, and then give you a score out of 100. See if you can overtake Brendan Gleeson's 83 points as he hangs on for dear life to top spot in our non-sportsperson sportsperson of the year race for 2024. Your father's Charlton Athletic career is one thing, but being the first proofreader of his classic addition to the football fiction canon, Goals for Glory, definitely wins you some points. Being there to witness that very same book sending your classmates into fits of ecstasy, well, you can take a couple more to the house. You cycled across America as a 21-year-old, the sort of quixotic effort that reminds me of Lady Rory McIlroy vainly tilting at windmills in an attempt to write the great Irish-American novel. And maybe there's a valuable lesson for Rory to learn in there. It's not about the majors you win, it's about the hobos you meet along the way. Your all-time sporting highlight made a bald 11-year-old a very, very happy young man. Your love of baseball reveals a nostalgic streak in you a mile long, but I am going to have to deduct some points for supporting the much-reviled New York Yankees. They already have celebrity superfan Billy Crystal. They don't need you too. This is bandwagon jumping of the first order. There's also a couple of games for Castlebar Mitchells, presumably under an assumed name, in clear breach of the Troika Ifigul of Cumann Lough Glasgale. That's going to cost you a few points as well. But I have to say it's been an excellent effort, and I'm happy to say that your efforts today are good enough for 78 points, good enough for third place in our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson race for 2024. Colm McCann, this has been your sporting life.
What do you think, Colm? Will your mum be happy enough listening with that score, or will we get a letter of complaint?
She'd be super happy. The one thing I will tell you is that I'm not a New York Yankees fan. Can I go up to 79 points for that?
Oh, hello.
Oh, so just this sense is your weakness, Murph.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm going to have to give you 80 points then. You know, because first of all, there's the factual error, and then there's just the embarrassment factor as well. So that's two extra points. So it's 80 points. I mean, it's still... Wow. Doesn't move you up or down the ladder, but
listen, I'm very happy. Sally's going to be very happy too. She's there in Dean's Grange. I'll be talking to her in 5 minutes.
Colm, listen, brilliant stuff. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thanks a million. Round of applause, please, for Colm McCann.
I am a lineman for the county.
and I drive the main road. And I need you more than want you. And I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Wichita Lineman by Glenn Campbell. That was for John Horgan, one of our greatest supporters and one of the most ardent listeners of this show from the very start. He is missed massively on what would have been his birthday weekend. Our love to all the Horgans today. Murph, it's falling apart for you. Colm asked politely for extra points and you folded like a cheap suit. It's a good thing he didn't inform you that you can still get your hands on an original 1976 hardback copy of Goals for Glory by his dad, Sean McCann, in very good condition for £71.25 plus shipping on the internet. And it has a picture of Georgie Good scoring a goal in his plimsolls in the front cover. You know, that would have really tipped you over the edge.
Yeah, I mean, he's not asking politely. He's just giving me more information. That's all. You know, it's that old Clement Attlee line. You know, what changed your mind? Events, dear boy, events. I mean, I hate to, for the third show in a row,
you're
struggling.
You're cracking under pressure. Every week you crack one way or the other. You give too many points. You give too few points. You're changing your mind halfway through. You're changing your mind right at the end. It's pressure's telling.
I respectfully disagree.
Saturday sport coming right up on another huge day at the Olympic Games. You can hear our own Olympics coverage on secondcaptains.com. This has been a Second Captains production for RTE. Killian Down produced. Mark Horgan is a series producer for Second Captains. Thanks to Johnny Lanagon in RTE. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.